hang up on technation, our brain hijacks our bodies and may not want us to lose weight. You may remember Dr. Sandra Amett, the author of Welcome to Your Brain. She's back with Why Diets Make Us Fat, the unintended consequences of our obsession with weight loss. Then on Biotechnation, looking for new drugs in the ocean. I'm speaking with Dr. Eduardo Eskenazi, the founder and CEO of Serenus Marine Discovery. All this coming up on this week's TechNation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
Who could be lonely when you own a refrigerator? I don't mean for the comfort of food. I mean for the fact that I saw refrigerators at the big CES consumer technology show that understood voice commands. There were also cameras inside, so you could see what's in there from anywhere using your smartphone. You can also ask questions and give orders, and you probably don't even have to be nice. But real friends are different. Generally, you have to be nice to them, or they will go away, as they should. CES is the place every year where new technology comes to say, "Hey, I'm here, and I have brand new features like you wouldn't believe." From refrigerators to cars to computers and more, it's anything that relates to consumer technology. There are entrepreneurs and businesses looking to attract media attention, investments, partners, and more. Still, this is a road best traveled by the strong. You can get here only to find out someone else has already produced your product, a chilling proposition. It may have lesser features, but a better name, or be a huge global company, or most depressing, they have really great show giveaways. People come to your booth holding them in their hand and walk away after eyeing your lowly bowl of hard candy. Worse, your budget-busting tchotchke just doesn't make the cut. Shaking off the competition is as hard at a show as it is reminding yourself that it's just a show. The demo works, but how healthy is the business? In today's world, it doesn't even need to be a real product. They tell you straight up, order it online, and when we get enough orders, we'll make our first batch of serial number ones. If it doesn't quite work the way it's advertised, you get a great deal on serial number two. But don't think this is snake oil. It's proven to be a valid way of doing business in these days of the internet. When the going gets tough, the tough rethink, revamp, re-strategize, and in today's vernacular, they pivot. They reframe what's going on. Someone big also building your product, they could buy you lock, stock, and barrel. Someone also tiny has a better feature, jump on it. You can make that feature. Maybe they didn't patent it, and maybe you can. Others may already have a better connection with consumers. Find yourself a successful business with a completely different product line, and quick as a rabbit, you add your product to theirs. But let's get back to our friend, the refrigerator. The fact that brand new technology appears each and every year at CES doesn't mean it's all useful. A few years back, the hot tech was all about curved TV screens. Since then, the only place I've seen them has been in casinos, rotated 90 degrees over slot machines, and delivering dazzling graphics to both the winners and losers alike. And the voice command fridges with the inside cameras? Well, the demo showed the neatest refrigerators I've ever seen in my life. For those of us who open our refrigerator doors and the light from the single light bulb is only a rumor, no worries. New tech is being built all the time. We'll adopt what works for us and leave behind what doesn't. And with or without cameras and voice command, the refrigerator can still be your friend. Just make sure it's not your date on Saturday night. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, science tells us why diets make us fat, the unintended consequences of our obsession with weight loss. Then on Biotech Nation, we're looking for drugs in the ocean. Turns out it's actually an old trick, but it works. In 1998, NIH, the National Institutes of Health, lowered the definition of overweight. Overnight, 35 million people became overweight. I asked Dr. Sandra Amett, the former editor-in-chief of Nature Neuroscience, what's up with that?
That was a really interesting decision. One important thing to know about it is that most of the members of the scientific panel who made that decision were the heads of diet clinics. Ooh. Who arguably had a conflict of interest in deciding that all these people were in need of their professional services. The other reason behind it is that the World Health Organization had just made a similar decision a couple of years earlier. But there was not very strong medical evidence that the degree of overweight that we now consider to be a problem has bad effects on health. And so whatever that decision was about, it wasn't mostly about science. And I think a lot of people just assume that these kinds of health advisories are always based in solid science. I think it's important to actually look at the evidence and figure out that that's not always the case.
Well, sometimes we go to a doctor and they're saying, well, you know, you can lose a few pounds, and they tell you how, you know, it's like they're actually telling you as an adult you should go on a diet. But scientifically, that may not be where you should be given your age.
Yeah, it's an individual question. And the main thing is that when a doctor casually says, yeah, you should lose 20 pounds, they're probably not taking into account how difficult that is. It's very easy to say you should lose 20 pounds. You, yeah. It's very easy to say I should lose 20 pounds, but it's actually pretty hard to lose a lot of weight and keep it off.
This brings into focus two different terms that you use. First is weight shaming or fat shaming, because it's basically saying you should be something different than you are. And secondly, the second term is defended range. Talk about them both in any order that works for you.
Yeah, let's start with the defended range, because I think that's an important part of the reason that weight shaming is so ineffective and wrong. So this is what used to be called the weight set point, and scientists now call it the defended weight range to emphasize that it's, in fact, a range of about 10 or 15 pounds for most people, not an exact weight. And that is the weight that your brain thinks is right for you. Your brain almost certainly did not consult your mother or your doctor in deciding what that weight range should be. And they may not agree, but for most of us, your brain gets the final say. We don't have perfect control over our weight. You know, you can imagine if you walked into the doctor's office and the doctor said, you got to drop 20 points of blood sugar. Yeah. You would hear that differently than you would hear, you got to drop 20 pounds. But in fact, they are both physiologically regulated quite strongly. And if you get outside of the range of the defended weight range that your brain thinks is right for you, what happens is that you get a lot of physiological responses that are engineered to drive your weight back to normal. And that's true on both ends, actually. If you get above your defended weight range, your metabolism will increase. Your body will burn more energy. You will become less hungry. You will find food less rewarding and become less motivated to seek it out. If you go below your defended weight range, you will become more hungry, more motivated to find food, which will be more rewarding to eat, and your body will burn less energy until you have gotten back into the defended weight range. Unfortunately, that response is not symmetrical. So the defenses against gaining weight are much less persistent and much weaker than the defenses against losing weight. That makes total sense from an evolutionary standpoint because we've had, as a species, 200,000 years of being at risk of starving to death and about maybe 50 or 100 years of being at risk, most of us, of eating enough to become really overweight. So, you know, our bodies have their defenses in place against what has been the persistent threat.
How do you know if you're at the top or the bottom of your defended weight range?
You can make guesses about that, but there's no way to know for sure. In general, people who have a healthy lifestyle, who exercise every day and eat a lot of vegetables and don't put themselves under huge amounts of stress are more likely to be sitting toward the low end of the range, and people who are in the opposite condition tend more likely to be sitting at the top of the range. You can even be outside of your range. I mean, there are people who spend months or years at a time eating when they're not hungry so often that they are actually maintaining a weight that's above their defended range. That's a risky thing to do because what happens is that that's one of the causes of the defended range creeping up over time with age. There are people who diet successfully and keep themselves below their defended range. You can probably tell if you're there because you are likely to be hungry a lot, and you're likely also to be cold a lot because that reduction in your body burning energy comes at the cost of the heat that gets released to keep you warm.
And if you're under long enough, will your defended weight range come down?
Doesn't appear to be the case.
I am so mad.
I know. It's totally unfair. Right?
So it can creep up but not
so
go
it
down.
It can creep up. And it, as far as anybody can tell, it doesn't go down. So there was a big study that came out in April this year where scientists at NIH looked at contestants on The Biggest Loser 6 years after they had lost over 100 pounds each. And by the time 6 years had passed, they had regained about 70% of the weight that they had lost. And they were still experiencing all of these symptoms of being below their defended weight range. And in particular, they were burning on average 700 calories less per day than would be calculated for the weight that they actually were.
So their body was it was set on getting back to that weight range.
Yep. And there was only one of the 11 contestants that they looked at who had not regained the weight. And of all of them, she had the worst metabolic suppression. Her body was burning even less energy than the rest of them. So, yeah, it was the reduction in the energy that they were burning was actually worse 6 years later than it had been right after they lost the weight. So not only had their bodies not gotten used to the idea of being below, but they were fighting against it even harder than they had been 6 years earlier.
Now, let's pile on the weight shaming. If whoever in your life or society in general or ads or whatever are saying to you, you should be a weight that's outside your defended weight range, you could be in real trouble.
There's a lot of discrimination and a lot of just general nastiness aimed at people who don't look the way that we think people should look. There are two parts to that, of course. One is that we all have, you know, if we consume enough media, we tend to form completely ridiculous ideas of how people should look because our models have a body type that only about 2% of women reasonably can be expected to have. That's the first part of the problem, that the standards that we have don't include anything close to the true diversity of natural body types. And then the second problem is, what difference does it make to you what somebody else looks like? Why is it your business what somebody else weighs? It's completely unfair that somebody who is obese and equally qualified has a lower chance of getting into college than a thinner person with the same grades. It's completely unfair that obese people get paid less on average than thinner people. There is no appropriate societal purpose that's getting served by that. It's just making a whole bunch of people miserable for no good reason.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Sandra Amott, the former editor-in-chief of Nature Neuroscience. Her earlier books are Welcome to Your Brain and Welcome to Your Child's Brain. You may be familiar with her TED Talk, Why Dieting Doesn't Usually Work, which has more than 3.5 million hits. She's here today with Why Diets Make Us Fat, the Unintended Consequences of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. Well, how? You couldn't possibly have imagined that 3.5 million people would click on your TED Talk.
Yeah, that was amazing and wonderful. And I think...
Do you wish you wore something different? I mean, if all these people were going to look at you.
I picked that dress very, very carefully. I love that dress, actually.
It's a good dress.
And I think it really speaks to how frustrated people are with the way that we normally talk about dieting and weight loss and, you know, how many people are out there looking for a better way to think about it and a better way to organize their lives instead of this constant yo-yo dieting that we end up, whether we know it or not, being trained to do.
Well, I usually say bravo when a book has, say, 12 to 15 solid scientific references. You have 435 scientific references in the back of the book. So, okay, Sandra, we believe you. Give us a landscape of all those scientific references. I mean, they're not just all saying, boy, if you're on a diet, you're going to be, you know, waging war with your defended weight range.
Yeah. So that is a very well-established scientific point. There is no serious question in the literature about the fact that people tend, when they lose weight, to gain it back, and that they tend to do that because the brain is trying to regulate their weight back to the defended range. But there are other scientific points in the book that I think are a lot less commonly appreciated. And one of those that's important to me is the relationship between dieting and binge eating, which was news to me as a chronic dieter myself for many years. I had no idea how dramatically I was increasing my risk of developing binge eating disorder through that behavior.
Just dieting in itself.
Yeah. And you say, oh, well, you know, kids shouldn't do ridiculous diets. People shouldn't be starving themselves. They should be on a sensible diet, you know, a reasonable number of calories and a reasonable amount of exercise. And it turns out that it's only just a very slight additional increment of risk if you're doing extreme diets. Regular diets are very nearly as strong a risk factor, especially for young girls.
Excuse me? Just a regular old diet, all those ones they constantly publish in the magazines. It's like everybody has, you know, a little this for in the morning and then a mid-morning snack. And it's like, you don't eat that way every day. Get out of here. You
know? Yeah. So what happens is that people very carefully follow the plan and they have their six almonds for this mid-morning snack and so on and so on and so on for a few weeks, maybe a few months if you're really tough. But gradually, as you are successful, because you are successful, because you have lost enough weight to get down below your defended weight range, the pressure is building up inside of your brain to gain that weight back. And at the same time, the willpower that you've been applying to the problem of counting out your almonds and weighing out your chicken breasts begins to tire. And gradually you reach a point, and almost everybody gets there sooner or later. Sometimes it takes a long time. But eventually, most people reach a point where the pressure to regain the weight is stronger than the self-control that they've been using to keep the weight off. And what most often happens at that point is some big, dramatic, oh, I'm no good. I can't do this. I'm a terrible dieter. I am going to eat all the things
that I've been missing. Bring me my pizza. Bring me my pizza.
I'm going to have pizza with chocolate cake on top.
And they do. And then, you know, I think many people need to understand that you struggled with weight for many years.
Yeah, and I struggled with weight in a very typical way, which is that when I started dieting as a young teenager, I was in the normal weight range for my height. So medically, there was no rationale whatsoever for my going on a diet. And yet, number one, you know, my mother was getting worried about my weight. And number two, the first time I lost 15 pounds, I heard from everyone I knew, oh, you are looking so good. Look at all that weight you lost. Man, you look great. And I was hooked, right? For somebody who is 13 years old and struggling with body image and feeling horrible and disgusting like pretty much every 13-year-old girl on earth, that is crack, right? I can do this and get everybody to tell me how great I look. And so I ended up losing weight, gaining it back like most people do, and losing it again, gaining it back again. I spent 30 years basically losing most years the same 10 or 15 pounds and gaining it back again. I was actually really lucky because a lot of people who weight cycle like that end up gaining back more weight than they lost.
And then their defended range moves up.
And then their defended range creeps up. So you can get into this cycle where you lose the weight and you gain back a little more, you lose it again, you gain back a little more still. And if you do that enough times, it's estimates on average are that about 40% of people who regain weight after a diet actually end up heavier than they were when they started. That, in fact, may be a contributor to the population weight gain that we've seen over the past 30 or 40 years.
You cite that 57% of women and 40% of men have been on a diet in the past year, and that half the female dieters are within the normal weight range. It means you're in the normal weight range, and yet you are dieting, which is upping your defended weight range. You're working against yourself.
Yep. Because you didn't want to be just in the normal weight range. You wanted to be at the bottom of the normal weight range. You are perfectly healthy as a size 10, but you feel the need to be a size 4.
It's all driven there. It's all driven there. It's one thing to voluntarily restrict your calorie intake for any number of reasons. But the military was interested in what does starvation do and recovering from starvation. And you talk about a study in just after World War II or toward the end of World War II, 1945, of volunteers to study the effects of starvation and returning from it. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so this was the first really systematic exploration of what starvation does to the human body. And the purpose of the study was to figure out how to most effectively rehabilitate the many, many people worldwide who were starving during the war. The war seemed to be winding down, and the researchers knew that they were going to have a humanitarian problem on their hands, and they wanted to get good data on what to do about it. So they recruited healthy young men who were not in the armed forces because they were conscientious objectors. They screened them very, very carefully for physical and mental health before the study started. And then they calorie restricted these men to 1,550 calories a day and had them walk 26 miles a week.
I'm speaking with Dr. Sandra Amott, the author of Why Diets Make Us Fat, The Unintended Consequences of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, we look all over the world for new drugs, all in bodies of water. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Dr. Sandra Amett, the former editor-in-chief of Nature Neuroscience. Today we're talking about why diets make us fat and the science behind it.
They screened them very, very carefully for physical and mental health before the study started. And then they calorie restricted these men to 1,550 calories a day and had them walk 26 miles a week. Incidentally, that's more or less what most of us would call a sensible weight reduction diet. And they
these days.
And they kept them on that diet until they had lost 25% of their body weight, starting from the normal weight range to begin with. These 35 men who had started out healthy did not stay in good shape for very long. And the thing that was most surprising to the researchers was how much their mental health deteriorated. So these guys became completely obsessed with food. They collected cookbooks. They talked about food all the time. They fought in the cafeteria over scraps of food. They were just completely taken over by the need to eat. My favorite little anecdote from that study is that there was a guy who on VE Day, when the Allies declared victory in Europe, he wrote in his diary about the crushing psychological consequences of having to stand in line too long for dinner. And he forgot to mention that we had won the war.
After all those years.
After all those years. The important thing was that he had to stand in line too long for dinner.
So, I mean, we have to understand what we're doing to ourselves with a diet. When we are starving ourselves in terms of what our body believes we should be taking in.
Yeah, that's the thing to understand, is that a person who started out at 300 pounds and lost 100 pounds may look to you like somebody who is at the right weight for their height. They may look that way to their doctor, but they don't look that way to their brain, and their physiology is completely different from the physiology of somebody who is exactly the same height and weight but is within their defended weight range. So you wouldn't be able to distinguish those two people in a lineup, but one of them is in a metabolically suppressed state. Their hormones are different levels from the person who is within their defended weight range. They are not experiencing the same biology as somebody who looks exactly the same but didn't have to lose a lot of weight to get there.
I think that's something that I don't think we realize. We say so-and-so is thin, and it's like, oh, what are you eating? If I just eat like you. It's like if they've been thin all their lives and you haven't been, this is not the same.
Right.
Yeah. Big piece of chocolate cake ain't going to make a difference for these people. You know? So it's different. We're talking about you cannot tell it from the outside.
Yeah. And different people, depending on their particular genetic makeup, may have more or less effective protections against weight gain. So there are people who can eat that chocolate cake and they will unconsciously, without thinking about it, work off 300 calories in exercise that they just spontaneously feel like doing without even realizing that it's happened. I'm not saying that the second law of thermodynamics doesn't apply. I'm saying that most of us don't have full conscious control or awareness of either how much we eat or how much energy we burn.
But they may get up the next morning and just say, I don't feel like breakfast this morning. I ate so much last night.
Yep.
Whereas the next person gets up and eats their normal breakfast. So it was a true additional load of calories in that regard. Just staying on the effects of the mental conditions, I was surprised to learn, whether it was anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, your statistics cover more than how prevalent they are. But what surprised me was that in each of these, there was a substantial consideration of suicide among all the people who were suffering from these conditions.
Yeah, anorexia is the single most dangerous mental health disorder in terms of the risk of death. People with anorexia are at a very high risk of suicide, and it's somewhat lower for the other eating disorders, but there's a significant burden of suicidal thoughts in all of the different kinds of eating disorders. Yeah, I think we take those much more lightly than we should. I have actually heard people say in public, well, you know, it's still worthwhile to fight obesity, even if it increases the risk of more people getting eating disorders because obesity is bad for you. And the answer to that is obesity is not anywhere near as bad for you as these eating disorders. And there are many, many things that we can do to mitigate the risks of obesity and allow people to live healthy, happy lives. It's much, much harder to mitigate the risks that are associated with eating disorders, though lots of people have tried.
Now, you're down how much weight from your personal best?
Oh, from my highest ever weight, I'm down probably about 25 pounds. Because as I went through those dieting cycles over and over again, I started swinging more dramatically. I gained more weight, and I went from a kind of a narrow range of 10 or 15 pounds. Eventually, by the time my crazy dieting hit its peak, I was swinging through about a 50-pound range, and I have settled right around in the middle of that since I stopped dieting.
A 50-pound range.
Yeah.
That's a big swing.
It is, and I used to own clothing in five different sizes, and I had a big box of clothes that don't fit right now but probably will again.
One way or the other.
One way or the other.
Wow.
And I now own only one size of clothing.
And that's not to keep you in that size.
No.
You've actually stopped dieting.
I stopped dieting in 2010. That was my New Year's resolution for the year, that I was not going to diet, that I was going to eat mindfully, you know, just eat when I was hungry and stop when I was full, and that I was going to exercise every day. And I'm still doing every one of those things 6 years later, and my weight has stopped moving around like crazy. It's settled within about maybe a 5-pound range.
Now, when you're saying mindful eating, waiting till you're hungry, and people have said to me, you know, I'm never hungry. What is that? Have they eaten past those feelings?
So that's one of the things that chronic dieting does to us, is if you systematically over the course of years suppress and ignore your hunger because you're trying to stick to your calorie plan even though you really want more food, eventually you will get out of touch with your hunger. You will have a hard time feeling it. You will actually have a hard time experiencing your body sensations in general, because people who are good at identifying one body sensation are typically good at identifying all of them. So one of the things that predictably happens with chronic dieters is that they sort of disconnect from their bodies. They start thinking that, you know, their bodies are not the important thing. They're just kind of to be tolerated and dragged around and ignored as much as possible. And then when you go back and say, actually, I would really like to to work with the natural weight regulation system by eating when I'm hungry, your body says, hunger? I haven't experienced hunger since 1998.
Now what?
Which is not true, but you haven't noticed.
It doesn't go away.
It doesn't. Yeah. There is nobody who actually doesn't have hunger. But there are people who don't understand what the signs of hunger are and how to detect them. The good news is that that is reversible. If you systematically pay attention over a period of time to how your body feels under various conditions, you can reacquaint yourself with your hunger and fullness signals. And people, I said, you know, people who get one body sensation tend to get all of them. One of the important applications of that principle is that people who are bad at detecting when they're hungry are almost uniformly also bad at detecting when they're full. So if you disable your hunger system, what you have done accidentally is also disable the protection, the guardrail that keeps you from eating way more than your body actually wants. And so that's part of the reason that dieting is actually associated statistically with weight gain in the long term, which is a systematic finding of more than a dozen studies, that if you take a group of people who are at the same weight with the same eating and exercise habits at the beginning, and you follow them for years, up to 15 years in some studies, you will find that on average, the people who were dieting when the study began weigh more than the people who were not dieting.
You also talk about something that I'd never heard about before called taste satiety. In that, will you explain it?
So taste satiety is the process of your tongue getting used to a new taste. And basically it happens a lot faster than most of us would guess. So the first bite of something always tastes the best. And the second bite is still pretty darn good. And the third bite is not quite as good. And by about the fifth bite, typically you can detect a real difference if you're paying attention in how good something tastes. So if your aim is to maximize the amount of pleasure that you get from eating the amount of food that your body needs, then paying attention to when you're really experiencing the pleasure of the food will lead most of us to realizing that you don't actually need a whole piece of cake to get most of the joy that you were going to get from the piece of cake.
Hence all those little petit fours you see in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Europeans are better at this than we are.
Yeah, tapas bars speak for themselves. That sounds really great. One last question here, and actually I could ask you a million questions, and I've got three sheets of them here, and we're not even getting to most of them. But when you say you exercise every day, what does that mean? It can mean so many different things.
That was a really interesting part of how my interaction with the world gradually changed after I stopped dieting. When I used to exercise when I was dieting, I did all the standard boring stuff. I went to the pool and swam laps. I walked for miles. And when I first stopped dieting and said I was going to exercise every day, what I did was I walked for half an hour every day. Half an hour is about the amount of exercise that it takes to gain most of the health benefits of exercise. But that was just something that I did because that was the form of exercise that I knew about. And gradually over the years, I've realized that what I was doing with exercise was the equivalent of somebody saying that, you know, it's good for you to play a musical instrument, so I'm going to practice scales for half an hour a day.
Ooh.
You don't run on the treadmill because running on the treadmill is the point, right? You do that because you want your body to work well enough that you can do the things that you actually enjoy doing. And so my exercise, quote-unquote, program has shifted gradually but dramatically away from I need to burn X calories or do X minutes to my two major sources of exercise these days are dancing and hiking. And I get probably somewhere between a half an hour and an hour a day on average of exercise. And it's all stuff I would do even if it were not good for me. It's all fun stuff. And that is such a different mindset. I mean, nobody gets out on the dance floor and says, oh, I got to put in another 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
So you got to find exercise that's at a lower level of things that you enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying, like, figure out 30 minutes a day, you know, and just they don't even have to be the same 30 minutes. It could be anything. Just find out a way to get this movement in your life.
Yeah.
And then you get the benefit.
Find something that you love. Find something you would do anyway. Don't probably set the bar that high to begin with. You may need to start with finding something you don't hate. But gradually, over time, you know, try some other stuff. I never in a million years would have guessed that dancing was going to be something that worked for me. If you had asked me 10 years ago, how do you feel about taking up dancing? I would have said, totally embarrassed. I have two left feet and there's no possible way I can do that. I'm nowhere near coordinated enough for dancing. And I started slow, I will admit. And I'm still not great. But I really like it.
Well, you know, I have to say there's so much we haven't talked about, such as creating good habits, getting 86ing bad habits, all kinds of things. And of course, when it's a habit, you don't think about it. And if it's a good habit for you and you're not thinking about it, this is a good thing, you know. So there's lots of science in here. There's lots of things to think about our lives and what can and can't be changed and what's the right thing for us, setting up our own. What weight should I be? And so lots more to talk about. I hope you come back and see us again.
Oh, I'd love to.
My guest today is Dr. Sandra Ammett. The book is Why Diets Make Us Fat, The Unintended Consequences of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. It's published by Current. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, looking for new drugs in the ocean. I'm speaking with Dr. Eduardo Eskenazi, the founder and CEO of Serenus Marine Discovery. I asked him, what exactly is bioprospecting?
Bioprospecting is the idea that we can go out into nature and look for valuable molecules or genes that might be present in certain environmental organisms that could be useful for human application.
And how does Serenus do that?
So we go out in the oceans, we collect small amounts of sponges, cyanobacteria, algaes, and we bring them back and process them. We only collect once, but we come back, we process them, and then start figuring out their application in different diseases.
Now, when you say you process them, what are you doing?
We're pulling out all the small molecules or metabolites, and we're organizing them in certain samples. So it's really a purification, stratification approach.
Do they need to be together?
They don't. So we try to bin them into unique buckets, and they're binned according to certain chemical properties.
Now, it would occur to me that they're not just – everybody's just floating around out there or tagged into the ocean or on the shore or under rocks, but they're all co-living together. So there's some symbiotic relationship.
Absolutely. I mean, these are – like a sponge is really like an apartment complex of
really?
All these other organisms. And there's bacteria, algae, fungus. Everything's living in there and – interacting, and there's it's like a little city or something going on. It's like Melrose Place. I don't know, something funny going on in there,
yeah,
right? And
so
there's
if
all
only
this.
We knew.
Yeah, you, yeah, it'd be a great reality TV show, I think. So it's these molecules that are mediating these interactions that are really our goal.
And the interactions are it is like an apartment house, and that everybody's interacting with each other.
That's right.
How do we know that?
Just the broad diversity of the different chemistry that's in there and the different applications that these molecules have.
And they actually communicate with each other.
Sure. They communicate or they prevent other organisms from eating them, or they defend their space or prevent toxins.
They eat each other.
They eat each other. Yeah. Yeah. So there's, you know, everything that we associate with kind of evolution is going on there.
Right. So you go out bioprospecting for these reality shows.
Yes, absolutely.
Sponges.
Yep.
And you take them back. Why are you looking there?
Just the chemistry that's been found in the ocean, especially, but in almost all natural environments, is much more diverse than anything that pharmaceutical companies make routinely. Especially in the ocean, this chemistry is much more complex, much more varied.
And unexpected.
And unexpected, absolutely. So it's really the seed of new chemical matter that's going to one day be drugs.
Okay. So now you come back and you extract the metabolites.
Yep.
And what do you do with them then?
So we begin testing them against different diseases.
And how do you do that?
So we work with partners or we do it internally, and we will test against cancer or for immuno-oncology applications or infectious disease. So we'll actually put them on a cancer cell or on a bacteria or a malaria parasite and see if it kills or impacts.
If there's any activity.
That's right.
Or if it runs.
Yeah, that's right.
Who kills who?
Yeah.
Who won its treatment?
Yep.
That's fascinating. One thing that I think is so interesting is in some senses this is both very creative but also a real long shot.
Right.
Does anybody know this is going to work?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was shocking to me when I found this out. So over 60% of all our small molecule drugs – were discovered this way. So
really?
Aspirin, penicillin, all these things were found from nature. They're all natural products. And pharmaceutical companies have gone away from this because it's very costly and difficult to find this chemical matter and to translate it from the organism to a drug. And really what we've worked on is approach to make it less costly and time consuming to be able to go from the discovery to the drug.
Now, where do you go? You can tell me.
I can tell you.
Yeah.
So we've been to Chile. We've been to Hawaii, other places in the Pacific. So really San Diego, actually, in our backyard. So went to Curacao recently on a deep sea sub with the Carmabi Research Station. And so we're really excited to process those samples.
So you're looking for real diversity around the world.
That's right.
Is warm water better than cold water?
It tends to have more diversity. It may not be better. I think the colder environments have been less explored. So there's maybe newer things there, but the general life is more dense in tropical areas.
So they're more candidates, but in the cold waters, they may be more robust.
That's right.
They can withstand any number
of things.
That's
right. Yeah. Right.
This, you know, it's a fascinating prospect once you start to look at the oceans and just for what is possible. It's huge.
Totally unexplored. I mean, we know less about the ocean than we know about the moon or about Mars and things like that. So
now, how did you get into this?
I was a graduate student in neuroscience. I was always a scientist. I was always a diver, always a surfer. So I had this love of the ocean, but I also had a love of science. And I got sick, I had cancer. And while I was doing my therapy, I learned a lot about the different drugs that I was receiving and the treatment plans that are available, and realized that a lot of those were actually natural products and were found in a similar way. So kind of started putting those things together and thought, what can I do with my life that really matters?
Now it counts.
Yeah, that's
got,
right.
Life got your attention.
Yes.
So, now, so did you pursue neuroscience or did you switch?
I didn't. I switched right away. I sought out people, really good people in the field. So at Scripps Oceanography, San Diego is a great community and they were very helpful and brought me in. I had the idea of starting the company right away. So my father was an entrepreneur, serial entrepreneur, and I just had that gene. And I said, this is what I'm going to do. And I set out to do it.
Now, where are you in the process? You've obviously gone out and collected a lot of stuff. You synthesized stuff, but we have any drugs yet?
So we don't have any approved anything or anything in the clinic, but we do have some payloads for antibody drug conjugates. So these are therapies that are targeted cancer therapies. So certain populations of cancer cells are targeted by a modality or some sort of mechanism and that delivers the types of drugs that we're discovering.
So you're not doing the delivery product. You're doing the payload.
That's right, where you've got the payloads. And so we have four new payloads that we've discovered, totally novel. We have a brand new antimalarial compound that we just 2 weeks ago found, totally new chemical class. And now we're doing immuno-oncology screens. So we're pushing this little pipeline forward.
Now, are these going to be biologic drugs? Are these going to be
small molecule drugs?
Small molecules, pills.
Pills, except for the antibody drug conjugates. So those are biologics.
Because they're big.
Because they're big.
They're big.
They're attached to a big molecule. That's
right.
Got it.
Well, Eduardo, thanks for coming in. Please come back. Keep us updated, won't you?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Hey, and don't forget, call us if you need people to go with you on these bioprocessing.
Why don't you just come with us?
There you go.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Dr. Eduardo Eskenazi is the founder and CEO of Serenus Marine Discovery. More information is available on the web at serenusmd.com. That's Serenus, S-I-R-E-N-A-S, serenusmd.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.